We are Acts chapter 19. For the last 4 weeks, I have promised you a riot, and we have been counting down since Easter, really. We've been counting down, thinking about religion and religious spaces, religious traditions, religious rituals. And the whole time I'm like, okay, hang with me. We're putting pieces together because we're working our way towards a riot. Well, this morning is the last week in our series, and this morning we get to look at a time in the early church where the Christians created a all-city riot in the second largest city in the world. There was a riot. And so this morning I want to give you my list for to answer your question, how do you start a riot? Because that's what we wonder. I want to give you my list for how to start a riot. Now, the problem with a series like this is the title's great, but the series itself is kind of set up to overpromise and underdeliver. So I'm going to give you my list, and it's a little overpromise, underdeliver. And as I was thinking about this particular sermon, I thought, you know what might be fun? And actually the idea came from Pastor Greg at Fairhaven. He's like, you know what I've been doing, Tim? I've been going around and asking people, how would you start a riot in West Michigan? So here's your answers, some of you. When I've asked you, how would you start a riot? Here's what you said. One person said, I would wear a Bernie Sanders hat to an NRA rally. And then that same person said, I would wear an NRA hat to a Bernie rally. There you go. They're politically confused. One person said, I would go to Tulip Time and tell people that the parade is no longer free. Should I find? Because Dutch people love free stuff. I'm Dutch. I could say it. That's why I've got a big nose. Air's free. Somebody said, I would turn. This is actually mine. Okay. I would turn on my hazards and just get out. This one actually happened to me. The other day, I'm driving down the street, and it's like one of those 25 miles an hour city streets, and there is two lanes, and the car in front of me just throws her hazards on and gets out of the car. But I'm right behind the car, and the other lane of traffic is full. So I'm just sitting there while they go do their errands or whatever it is. You do realize that the hazards are not a, like, I can do whatever I want lights, right? But it's not like a pause button on life. Like, you know what? I got my hazards on. No one will care. That's mine. Okay, number four, that's that one. Number five, this is my favorite. Last but not least, this is my favorite. I would ask mom today, Mom, what's for dinner? Yes, yes. By the way, moms, happy Mother's Day. We love you. On behalf of all of us who were born, thank you. We love you. Would you give it up for your moms? Yeah. And special Jesus points, that isn't a thing, but for today it is. Special Jesus points if you came to church with mom today. So special Jesus points, give yourself a pat on the back. Again, it's not an actual thing, but you can pretend it is. It makes you feel good. But it's Mother's Day, and we're talking about rioting. It should be good. Now, that's not the actual list. I do have a list. I want to give you five-ish, depending on time. I want to give you five-ish practical ways to start a riot that just kind of come right out of the early church and what they did to start a riot. Five simple things, but specifically this morning, I want to talk to those of you who every once in a while you find yourself feeling more and more out of place in the world that you live in. Every once in a while, you look around and think, like, the world that I live in, like, people are talking past each other. No one's really listening to each other. It's constantly like everyone's walking on eggshells. We can't really talk about any issues anymore, or we like offend somebody. And I don't want to offend somebody, but at the same time, like, we can't talk about any issues anymore. And so you go to the stores, you wear the clothes, you drive the cars, you go to the jobs, and yet you feel more and more out of place in this world. I want to talk to those of you who find yourself in that space this morning, because that is the space that kind of kicks off the riot that launched 2,000 years ago. Now, before we talk about that specific riot, I want to take you through the city. I want to give you like a layout in your head I want you to get a map in your head so that when we read through it, you get a sense of, okay, here's where we are. These are the places that we're going to. So first, the city is Ephesus. I took this picture 10 years ago, and I was telling the people before the service that I bought a brand new camera when I was going to Turkey 10 years ago, and I was like, this camera has like all the megapixels, and it's so, like, 10 years, look at that. So if you go to Israel, don't worry about your camera, because 10 years from now, it's just going to look like garbage. But this is a picture of, if I ever do have a chance to take you to Turkey, or if you have the chance to go to Turkey, one of my favorite experiences is hiking a back of a mountain, and like a small mountain. And then you get to the top, there's like this cross thing, and you realize there's a lookout over the city of Ephesus. Ephesus was, even the ruins themselves, like just looking down on the ruins, are utterly impressive. Second largest city in the ancient world, massive theater, 250,000 people or 25,000 people, I believe, could be seated in the theater. The city itself was 250,000 people, about the size of Granville and Wyoming together, like just a pretty large city for their day and age. The city of Ephesus is impressive. Now, let me show you a diagram so you get a sense of kind of what. Oh, there it is on a map. So last week we looked at the city of Sardis. Sardis is number 5. And then today we are looking at the city of Ephesus. It's a port city. It's number 1. It is a major city. It is Rome, because Rome is in charge. It is Rome's entry point into the West. So, or into the East. So this is Rome's entry point into the East. The city of Ephesus was massive. Now let me give you kind of an artist rendering of what it would have looked like. You have 3 major streets, and then a 4th one that is kind of set off just for the worship of a particular god, which we'll look at. But there are 3 major streets. So if you were to come in off the harbor, which today has receded, it sits on the corner of the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean. So if you were to, in Paul's day, one of the first Christian missionaries, you get on a boat, you come off the harbor, and you were to walk on this street. This street is known as Harbor Road. It's a fitting name for a road. Harbor Road. Harbor Road, if you walk down, it ends at a massive theater. The theater, by the way, is the site for the riot. So remember this theater. This is where the riot takes place. The theater itself is pretty stunning. It is 3 tiers up. This is not my picture, I thought this picture captured well, like what it feels like to be at the top. Remember, the old Silver Dome? Anybody go to the old Silver Dome and sit at the top? And it's like you get the fear of, anybody, if you have a fear of heights, like you sit up there and it's like, you get the same kind of sensation of like, okay, I'm really high up. This thing is really, really large. Now, if you were to leave the theater, and if you were to take a right off of Harbor Road, hang a right, you are now on Marble Road, known because it was a marble road. And go back one more real quickly. So if you see in the top right corner, right below the big white box or the other little white box, that is the library. I'll take you there. That is this right here, that structure here. So this is Marble Road. So in the top right corner, you have the theater. So you get a sense of the land. You walk down harbor, theater, you hang a right, you now are at library. Now, if you're standing, here's a closer up of the library. By the way, this library is the second largest library in the ancient world. That's known as the Celsus Library. This is a day and age where not everyone read. So to have this large of a library said something about who you are as a culture, what you wanted to be as a culture. Now, so that's the library. Now, if you were to stand in the library and look out, here's what you would see. This is Curates Street. Curates Street. It's absolutely incredible. So you kind of get the lay of the land. You come in off the harbor, walk down Harbor Street, you have theater. Hang a right. By the way, off to the right, right before the library, is an agora. One of 2 agoras. Agora is a marketplace. So you would sell or buy and sell whatever it is you did. So whatever you made in one of the 2 agoras. There's an agora right by the library. And then if you head down from the library, hang a left, head down Curate Street, that you have where the yellow arrow is, it's not the theater. That is what is known as a bulletarian. It is where politics happened. So it is where you would watch the debates. I'm going to take you in closer to that. You'll see it's looks like the theater, but it's a little bit small, quite a bit smaller. So that's that. And then right across the street from that, where the red arrow is, it's just a bunch of trees today, but that is the other agora. So Paul works making something. Do anybody know what Paul makes? T- tents. Paul's a tent maker. So Paul makes tents. He works in one of the two agoras, most likely this agora, because this was the main agora. The other was kind of the state agora. This is the main marketplace. So you get a sense of the lay of the land. Okay, let's get into the story. Verse 23, Acts 19. Oh yeah, in the agora today, like right outside the agora. I found this to be just funny. Genuine fake watches. Yeah. So I want me one of them. Okay, verse 23, Acts 19. Verse 23, Acts 19. About that time, there arose a great disturbance about the way. Let me pause there. This is my absolute favorite description of the church. What the church was referred to by the very first believers was, it was referred to as the way. The church was not a building. It was not a religion. It was an entire way of living. It was a way of raising your families, running your business. When the church was described by those outside of the church, they would refer to the church as, oh, they follow the way of Jesus. Okay, so there's a disturbance that arose about the way of Jesus. Verse 24, a silversmith named Demetrius, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought in no little business for the craftsmen. He called them together along with the workmen and related trades and said, men, you know we receive a good income for this business, and you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. He says that man-made gods are no gods at all. There is danger, not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited, and the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty. So, pause the story. We are introduced to a guy by the name of Demetrius. Demetrius is he's a craftsman. He works making little shrines to the god Artemis. Now, the question is, who's Artemis? We've talked about Artemis for the last couple weeks, but last week we looked at a little bit of the Kibla Artemis and the worship service of Kibla Artemis. Aren't you glad I did it last week and not on Mother's Day, for those of you who are here? Like, it's real awkward and bloody. But we saved some of the most interesting stuff on Artemis. Who's Artemis? Artemis, in verse 35, we're given a hint. So in the same story, if you jump ahead, we're given a hint. The city clerk quieted the crowd, it says, and said, fellow Ephesians, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple, what is known as Neocorus, if you want to look that up, really interesting, as a guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of her image, which fell from heaven. So here's the myth. One day, in the sky, you see fire, and then down from the fire lands a meteorite. The meteorite is black. It has come from heaven and has descended to earth. This must be a sign, or maybe this itself is a god. It's come from heaven, it has descended to earth, and it is now here. And so we must build around this meteor a house, a temple, so that we can worship whoever it is that brought life, who gives us life, that we see in this black meteor. This meteor they called Artemis. I don't know why they referred to her as a her. I don't know how you can tell the gender of a meteor, but they did. And what they do to celebrate this god Artemis is absolutely like over the top. A couple weeks ago, Tierra showed us a picture of the temple. Massive temple, largest temple in the world, was in Ephesus. Acts 19 talks about the temple. So we have the temple in the story. Now, in Ephesus itself, let me take you back to the diagram. You have the theater. So you have Harbor Road, theater. And then if you were to hang a left, you have Processional Way, they refer to it. Processional Way. And at the end of the Processional Way, you have the temple to Artemis. Now, Processional Way was where there would be a procession. The procession would involve children dressed in white. The procession would involve a sacrifice made by priests. If you weren't here last week, again, happy Mother's Day. We're not going to recreate that. But it was just a bloody, bloody thing. The temple was massive and ornate. It was paid for by a king, the king of Lydia, a king by the name of Croesus. Croesus found gold in the Pactolus River. Again, if you were here last week, hopefully you're making some connections. If you weren't, don't worry about it. It's just a massive temple. massive, massive temple, all built around this particular stone. One person, and again, just some recap here. One person, a guy by the name of Antipater of Sidon, describes the temple. Pastor Tia read this a couple weeks ago. He says, "I've seen the world. I saw the pyramids. I saw the great wall of Babylon where chariots can ride on top of the wall. But when I saw the house of Artemis that mounted to the clouds, those other marvels lost their brilliancy. And I said, lo, apart from Olympus, the sun never looked so aught so grand." That was from the time of right around the time of Jesus. This is how it was described. Now, this all raises the question, who is Artemis? Who is Artemis? Why is she such a big deal? Let me show you a statue of Artemis. Lovely. This is Artemis. Artemis was the goddess of fertility and life. So it is believed that those are either eggs or breasts on the statues of Artemis, because Artemis brings life. Now, why do they portray Artemis like this? Why do they show her like this? Well, this gets at why Artemis is such a big deal. Artemis gave you this promise. This black rock that fell from heaven gave you this promise. In a world in which one out of two women died in childbirth, Artemis promised you that she could keep you alive. Again, we talked a bit about this last week. But she promised you that she could keep you alive. And she came through on her promises. Statistically, you were far more likely to survive childbirth. In a world in which 1 out of 2 women died in childbirth, you were far more likely to survive childbirth if you went to the temple of Artemis. Why? Because Artemis priests were trained in medicine. They were doctors. So you have a daughter. You have a wife, and she's pregnant. The question is, do you go to the temple? Because she can keep you alive. You're pregnant, and you know that the odds of you surviving this is like maybe 1 out of 3 on a good day, but the odds of you and this child growing inside of you both surviving is flip of a coin. You want to meet your little this life growing inside of you. Do you go to the temple of Artemis? You see how it's not just like a, where do I go to church this Sunday? I mean, this is like, to say no to Artemis is to say no to potentially meeting this child. But it's not just this. She also, in her temple, she provided free meals. They had a whole meal program that they did. So if you're hungry and you lived in Ephesus, you could go to the temple of Artemis and you could get a free meal. Pretty good deal. She also offered free fire. So in a day and age where you couldn't just turn the heat on, you needed fire. If the fire in your house burned out, where do you go to light your torch? Well, there was an everlasting flame, they referred to it as, an everlasting flame in the temple of Artemis. And you could go and you could light your torch. Do you go? But it's not just that. Financially, Artemis brought in a lot of money for the people of Ephesus. Financially, a tremendous amount of income could come from you working for Artemis. We meet a man named Demetrius. His job is making those little statues of Artemis. There's a lot of money to be made. So do you do it? Fertility, fire, food, financial success. Do you do it? By the way, do you see how for the early Christians, it wasn't inviting people into the way of Jesus wasn't just a believe a thing. Like for the early Christians, what they recognized was, if we're going to really let people know that the way of Artemis is a fraud, we're going to need to make sure that we can protect, we got to love those children. If we're going to make sure that we can really, really help, we need to feed people who are hungry. Like it was far more than just a, do you believe a certain thing? It was, we got to live a certain way. Now, Artemis wasn't all great. Obviously, we talked a little bit about this last week, but Artemis wasn't all like sunshine and Ed Sheeran songs or whatever other things are happy. Ed Sheeran? No, you don't know who Ed Sheeran is? Jared doesn't know who Ed Sheeran is. Okay, Ed Sheeran. ADD moment. Again, happy Mother's Day, everyone. But it wasn't all She wasn't all perfect. In fact, here's one of the dilemmas if you live in Ephesus. Major dilemma. You have 250,000 women coming to you every single year to give birth to their children. That is double the amount of women that gave birth in our entire state last year. What happens if one of those children dies? Or what happens if one of those children is born with, if any way the people said, well, this baby isn't perfect. For whatever disgusting reason you wanted to create, this baby isn't worth raising. What do you do? Because Artemis's reputation hangs on delivering you a child. Well, apparently you best offer this child as a sacrifice to Artemis. You give your child up. And so there was this whole practice that developed around Artemis. They referred to it as exposing the infant. And again, we walked through this in great detail a couple of years ago, so I'm not going to go into all the detail, but let me give you the Cliff Note version. You could take your child by Roman law, protected by the military, and you could bring your child. Ephesus is built into the side of a hill. You could take your child to around the back of the hill, just on the other side of the theater, and you could leave your child. And then you could walk away. Absolutely disgusting. There's you stand in Ephesus and you get this feel of like, oh, what would it have been like to be the early Christian church living in this world? But what makes it even more disgusting is there were people, usually men, but there were people that would sift through the pile of babies that were discarded, and they would be looking for babies that they could take and that they could raise to do one of two things. One, to sell in the agora, boys especially, strong boys. They're looking for strong boys that they could sell as slaves in the agora, in the marketplace. Paul makes tents. Next to him, there are boys being sold into slavery. Think about this. Why in the book of Ephesians does Paul talk so much about slavery? Ephesus was the slave hub of the East, right off the coast. Little girls would be picked through to fill the brothels. Let me show you another picture. It's a pretty cheesy diagram, but okay, so you see the theater, you see Harbor Road, you see Marble, you see in the red circle, that is the library, and circled in the yellow is, on the diagram, if you can squint and read it, it's called Love House. And guesses as to what that is. Right on the corner of Main Street and Main Street. Let me show you. So you see the library. This building was a brothel. This was the culture of Ephesus. Artemis promised you food and fire and financial success. And at the same time, Artemis turned a blind eye to all kinds of perversion, to the abandonment of children, to kind of the earliest forms of abortion, all the way to the earliest forms of prostitution, legalized, sanctified by the state itself. This is what it means to live in Ephesus at the time of Paul. Now, Paul gets off a ship. And he comes down, bumps into the theater, turns a right, sets up shop in one of the two agoras where he sells tents. He meets a man named Demetrius because he's selling tents, but he's not just selling tents. As people discover, he's living a certain kind of way. He doesn't get his food from Artemis. He doesn't get his fire from Artemis. He's not doing the ritual going over to the side of the hill. He's not trading humans. He's making tents. And so people start asking questions. And a movement starts to gather under Paul. As Paul begins to tell more and more people about Jesus, and it starts to hurt the finances of the person who's selling statues to Artemis. In this case, it's a guy by the name of Demetrius. Pick up our story again, verse 28. When they heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Soon, the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and rushed as one man into the theater. Now we have a mob. We have a mob. They grab Paul's two friends and they seize them and they bring them off to the theater as one person. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Let me read. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. So we have a mob, and the mob is now turning towards a riot. Everyone rushes into this 30 or 25,000 person theater. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. I love this line. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. It's like, why are we? Do you ever watch like a political rally? There's the people in the front that are like, ah, and then the people in the back are like, yeah. The Jews pushed Alexander to the front, and some of the crowd shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. But when they realized he was a Jew, they shouted in unison for about 2 hours. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. You get the scene in your head? There's a riot. The riot starts as a mob. It moves to the theater. And all of a sudden, the Jews realize what's going on. And so they push out. When you read Jews, this is early Christians, right? These are Jewish people who believe in the way of Jesus. They follow the way of Jesus. They push out this man, Alexander. And Alexander stands on the base of the stairs in the theater, whatever that is, that platform. And the crowd is just shouting. And then you almost picture it. Somebody whispers over and says, that's Alexander. He's one of us. He's got a Greek name. This is Alexander. He's named after Alexander the Great. He's a Greek. But he's a traitor because he's starting to follow the way of Paul, who follows the way of Jesus. And you can almost picture in the midst of this crowd where people are just gathered, someone shouts out, he's a Jew. And out of that then comes this in unison cry of great is Artemis of the Ephesians, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And while this whole thing is happening, we read that Paul wants in there. He wants in. He hears it. They're ready to pounce. Alexander, can you imagine being Alexander? Like, Paul wants in. Why does Paul want in? Because what is happening in Ephesus, though looks great on the outside, makes Paul absolutely sick. It is why I believe that when you read the stories of Paul's movements through the early church, Paul camps out in Ephesus longer than any other place. It's almost as though you get the sense that Paul realizes this community needs Jesus more than anyone, even though they would be the last to think it. They're wealthy, they're powerful, they have one of the largest harbors in the ancient world, massive theaters, gold, a street made of marble. And yet they're spiritually poor. And you feel Paul, like, what is happening here isn't right. What is happening here isn't good. Someone should do something about this. For Paul, it's not religion, faith. Jesus is not just a religion. It's not just about a space. It's not just about a ritual or a tradition. We spent some weeks talking about this. But for Paul, it's about a whole way of life, and it's a way that every once in a while, and often actually, bumps into the practices that we find ourselves in. 3 weeks ago, the cathedral in Notre Dame burned. You watched it like I did on the news. And thankfully, we were able to put out the fire. I am the first to say I'm really grateful that we were able to save the building. I saw a lot of your pictures that were posted of you in front of the cathedral. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful cathedral. As Tiara said, I'm not into Gothic architecture, so it's not necessarily my definition of beauty, but it is got all kinds of history behind it. And I was watching the news that day, and $700 million was raised in like a couple of hours, and that's beautiful. Hear me on this. It's beautiful. I'm glad we could do that. I'm glad that we now have the money for reconstruction. But just a couple days before that, the UN, the United Nations, said that for $929 million, we could essentially save 1.25 million Rohingya people. The people in our world who are the most under, like, it's genocide. They're just wiping them off the map. And The refugee camps continue to fill, and then they wipe them off the map. And it's one after the next after the next. A couple weeks ago, we showed Tanner Smith, one of our pastors who went to work with Partners Relief and Development. And Tanner gave us that video, and he said, hey, don't show this until Sunday because it's not safe for me to be here. For almost the same amount of money that we raise in a few seconds. And hear me, I'm glad we could raise the money. The space matters. It matters. But we could have... I think every once in a while you see Paul like bump into some of this and say, like, religion is not about a space and it's not about a ritual. It's not about a tradition. At its most pure, at its best, a religion that matters is the religion, is the faith, is the way that goes up the mountain and saves those children. A religion that matters is the one that goes into the brothels and reminds the women there that you are not just what that guy says about you. How to start a riot. Here's five practical ways to start a riot. Step number one, Paul sold tents. Start there. Paul sold tents. Every day Paul went into the agora and he sold tents. And people saw something in Paul. And he sold tents. He didn't push anything. He just sold tents. And people saw something in Paul and they asked questions. And Paul answered their questions as he sold his tents. And they asked about Paul's motivation because I'm guessing that Paul recognized his goal wasn't to sell the tents. His goal wasn't to make the money off the tents. He will, like, you got to survive. But for Paul, the motivation to live is a little bit deeper. And so I'm assuming that people bumped into that and they had some questions. Why aren't you more cynical, Paul? Everyone around you is so cynical. Why aren't you more cynical? Where does the joy come from? Paul sold tents. You go to work. You go to school. You raise a family. What you do may feel very mundane. There are days where I look at what I do and I think, does any of this really matter? Am I making any difference? There are days where it can feel like you just are going through the motions. And you can even be tempted into thinking that the people that actually make a difference in the world, they are the people that have the money to do that, or it's the politicians, or it's the celebrities. Those are the people that actually make a difference. The most I can do is vote for the right person. And so we get then really worked up about making sure we're voting for the right person because that's the only difference we can make. And it's then really easy to get really cynical about the whole thing. But Paul enters into a city that honestly doesn't really need him or want him. And he just goes to work making tents. And we don't think about this often, but this is what he did day in and day out. Like, evening comes, sun goes down. What does Paul do? He goes and he beats the leather. He goes and he dyes the wool. He goes back in the woods and he's looking for sticks. Paul goes to make tents. And then in the day, he goes and he sells his tents. It's a lot of work. And again, we don't think about this a lot, but apparently his tents are good. How do I know this? Because you don't start a whole movement where people are worried if you're ripping people off and selling fraudy tents, right? Like, these are apparently really good tents. They're not garbage. His whole movement would be discredited. So how do you start a riot? You start at work. You start in the house. You start at school. You put in the work. You work hard. You do it. You do it without, you fight cynicism. You fight laziness. You do the work. And people start asking you questions. And they do. Like, it's those of you who they ask you questions. Why? Where do you get the joy? And when they do, you answer the questions. Every once in a while, somebody will get mad at you for having joy in the work. But every once in a while, what you discover is there are a lot of people, some people get mad, but a lot of people actually, they become your friends in the midst of it, which is step number two. You become friends. How to start a riot, step number two. There's a beautiful line tucked away in the story we read. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. The line says this. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent a message begging him not to venture into the theater. Paul's friends with the people that work for Artemis. Step three, be patient. Be patient. We right now live in a call it out world. Have you noticed this? Like, we will call out what you're doing. And More and more people are calling out what other people are doing. And that, in some ways, that's okay. But in some ways, I wonder if it's just like, we just got to take a beat. Take a breath. Be patient. What we discover with Paul is he simply models a better way to live first. Now, he'll speak out. Absolutely, he'll speak out. But first, he models a better way to live. In fact, notice verse 37 in the story. This is what the city clerk who gets up to defend Alexander and Paul, this is what he says. You have brought these men here, though they have neither robbed temples nor blasphemed our goddess. So the critique is that Paul is speaking against Artemis. This guy is stealing our money. He's saying that Artemis is a fraud. But what you hear from the city clerk is this guy's not talking bad about Artemis. You see, when you live the way of Jesus, you don't have to go tell everybody else that they're doing it wrong, because the way you live is contagious enough. Which brings me to step four, because you're asking the question I would ask right now, which is, what about injustice? What about when what you see is so wrong that to do nothing and to say nothing and to just try to live a quiet life doesn't cut it? They were dropping off babies on the side of a hill. Paul does speak up. He writes a whole letter to a group of people who are trying to follow the way of Jesus. It's called Ephesians, and he speaks up in the letter. Paul does speak up, and if you're given a platform to speak up, you should speak up. But in speaking up, you know what he always says to the majority of people? The best way to live is to simply do the right thing. Live the right way. In fact, in the letter to the Ephesians, he begins that letter by saying, "For this reason, ever since I heard about your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love for all God's people, I have not stopped giving thanks for you." That's how he kicks it off. Your love for all God's people. Why does he use this language? You know what the early church did? Again, we've talked about this before, but maybe one of the most important teachings we can do. You know what the early church did in Ephesus? They climbed the mountain next to the slave traders who were picking out babies, and they took the babies themselves, and they raised those babies. They adopted those babies and raised those babies as their own. To this day, we refer to the hill as Adoption Hill. Mother Teresa was once asked, "Mother, how do we change the world for Jesus? How do we do great acts for God?" Her response was, "There is no such thing as a great act for God. There are only small acts done with great love." There is no such thing as doing a great act for God. There are only small acts done with great love. And three generations after Paul, the entire world, the entire province of Asia was Christian, like 80% Christian. It went from being a sect, a cult, a group of people gathered in a house, to an entire movement. We'll skip that. Step five. I'll just read it. Remember that this is not about you, but rather this is about helping all people everywhere find their way back to God and inviting all people everywhere to wake up to the real pain of our world by reminding them that following Jesus is not about some words you say, but an entire way of living in which we let go and trust that the God who created all things holds all things. And that includes you, and that includes me, and that includes them, and that includes your friends, and that even includes your enemies, because your job is not to judge them, but to love them. And in so doing, you make them friends, and in becoming friends, you help them find their way back to God. Okay, one more. Bonus step. I said five. Here's step six. The early Christian pooled the resources and they threw better parties. That's where we talked about on Easter. They threw better parties. They referred to the meal that they threw often, regularly. They referred to this meal as a love feast. A love feast. Now, there's a couple rules to the love feast. Rule number one, those of you who are wealthy who can get out of work early for the love feast have to wait for those who are poor. Rule number two, slave and free, you eat together. Male and women, you share the table. There's no privilege at the table. Everyone's at the table. The rules at the table are all are invited, and it's equal at this table. And they called them love feasts because they were a feast. They were a party. The rules at the feast, Paul often used the feast as a platform to talk about the movement, the way of Jesus. The letter to the Ephesians, if you read the letter to the Ephesians in your Bible, you will notice that there are specific rules in the letter. Why? Because Paul is dealing with the chaos of a group who for the very first time realizes that they are loved. Paul opens the letter to the Ephesians, to those who are chosen, who are adopted, who are predestined by God. Now, Paul's not talking about the silly little theological debates we find ourselves in of like free will or predestination. He is talking to children who have been adopted, chosen, and predestined, most likely from the side of the hill. When Paul talks about women should in church, women should stay quiet in church. Women in church should not let their hair down, and women in church should not wear jewelry. He is not writing to 21st century Americans. He is writing to women who had to let their hair down because they were told that the only worth you have is to fill the brothel. Your value comes from what he says about you. And what Paul says is not in the movement of Jesus. Women, you get a seat to listen. You don't just do, you have a seat and you have a space here. Now, there's some things to unlearn, right? There's some things to unlearn in it. You were taught that letting your hair down, wearing the jewelry, all signs of the women who filled the brothel. You were taught that that's how you get your worth. Not in the movement. And they referred to this as the way. And every week they had a feast. And they called the feast the love feast. And all were welcome. And they modeled something new. And they cared for the babies. They didn't just protect a woman in childbirth. They actually loved the children. They didn't just hand out food. They actually ate the food with them. They didn't have the financial resources of great wealth, but what they did have, they pooled together and they shared together and they made sure no one was hungry and no one was in need. And it exposed Artemis for who she was. You're just a government program. You're just a free handout. This cannot hug me and this cannot love me. And the movement of Jesus, like fire to a pile of leaves, just launches. And you and I today, we have what we call communion. It's just a little bit of bread and a little bit of juice. But it's to remember the feast that the early church had, which they had to remember the way of Jesus. We have to work really hard to not let this just become about a tradition or a ritual or just like this is the space we live in. This is what we do in this space. Like we have to work really hard when we take communion to remember that Jesus didn't just come to launch a religion. Jesus came to inaugurate a whole new way of living in this world. And you and I, we get to be a part of it. Thank you, Mom. You brought us into the world. We get to be a part of the way of Jesus. So this morning, we're going to celebrate communion. And we want to invite you into that. If you've never yet stepped into a relationship with Jesus, I just don't want to miss the opportunity to invite you into it. If faith for you has always just been about a bunch of head beliefs, I mean, it often starts in our head, but if it's just been a bunch of things you believe, we want to invite you into something deeper, into actual rhythms and practices in which we are thinking about those in our world who need us. They need the church. And we want to invite you to the table. We often talk about three different meanings with communion. We come in remembrance of what Jesus did. We come in communion. We come in community together, community with God. And we come in great hope of who our God, that he will come again, that he has not left us. He has not abandoned us. The groom has not abandoned his bride. And so this morning, I don't know what it is for you that you need to be reminded of. Maybe it's you just need to be reminded that God does love you because you've gone through something and you feel lonely. Maybe you do feel lonely and you need to be reminded that you're part of something far bigger. You're part of a community. You're part of a community with God, that God calls you his children. Or maybe for you, it's you need some hope this morning. You're battling something and you need to be reminded that God does not give up on you. God has not given up on your family. God is not, your pain has not gone unnoticed. So we have a few stations in the front. I think two on the sides are gluten-free and then the three in the middle are not. There's none in the back, you'll notice anymore. We just have them up in the front. So just come on down. Fight the chaos. Come on down. Rob's always telling me the best way to do this. I just don't remember it. So I think it's everyone go out to the. I just figure it out. You're smart people. You're far smarter than me. But come on down. There's again gluten free on the sides. But let me say a word of prayer for us, Lord. We thank you for. Lord, I thank you that 2,000 years ago you broke into the monotony of history. Lord, we were just going through the motions. Lord, we were just going through the motions, bowing down to the gods that we served. And Lord, you broke into history and you reminded us of a far bigger story. And Lord, I am so grateful. I am so grateful that you have gathered us together as your church. I am so grateful that 2,000 years ago, you used men like Paul to wake the world up to things like racism and slavery and bigotry and prejudice. And Lord, I am grateful that today we get to continue to wake up to the work you're doing in our world. And as we take communion this morning, Lord, we do not do this simply as a religious act or duty. But Jesus, this morning we take communion as a way of saying we're in. We are in on whatever it is you're leading in this world. We're in on the mission. Jesus, we love you, and we pray this in your name. And everybody said, amen. On the night.